It's awesome that you guys have already read the text, so that will save us a little bit of time, so I don't have to bumble through that time frame. But this morning, I'm in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, 6 through 13, continuing the text as you guys have been trekking through, so I get to pick up there. And just for a subject, I just want to talk about the problem with people, platforms, pedestals, and puffiness. The problem with people, platforms, pedestals, and puffiness. We live in a time and in a generation where we've been trained since being almost infants that we must choose sides. We grow up choosing sides. If you're a young man and your dad was a baseball fan, football fan, basketball fan, soccer fan, he dressed you in a certain way. That's the only time dads care what the kids are wearing. It's on Sunday morning or Saturday night. I need to put you in the right colors. I need you to be for the right team. You know, and so with that in mind, you know, even from a babe, we are taught and trained that we must be on the right team. As we look around this room and we see the banners in the back, we know that we are drawn in to picking a side. That is kind of our whole psyche. And especially being American, we're used to picking sides. Our country is going through one of the most horrible ordeals being lived out in public view right now as we are choosing sides. Even in the evangelical culture, we're choosing sides apart from the gospel. And so when we look and we begin to understand that, we know that we've spent our whole lives choosing sides. And the Corinthians are no different. The Corinthians are no different because there must be a hero. That's our nature. Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. There must be a hero. And even in evangelical culture, we've picked our own heroes. Driscoll, Piper, Chandler, Mason. You name them. Sproul, Swindoll. Evans, we've picked our own heroes to champion even in the day that we live in. Don't let me miss the sisters. Please don't let me miss Beth Moore and Prashira Shirer and, you know, the likes of those. We don't want to miss those. We don't want to just say that it's the brothers. But we've all chosen our heroes in the culture that we live in, as the Corinthian church did. And here's the deal. The church of Corinth gives us an ancient view of a modern Facebook debate. For you social media junkies, you know where I'm going with this. You know, we're always on Facebook picking sides, choosing sides, letting loose our theological atrocities on Facebook, our heretical hummings. We say all kinds of things, and we even will attack people from whom we do not know, simply because they're not in our tribe, they're not on our team, they don't come from our club, they're not part of our clique. And so we can't get with them. See, the problem in the church with celebrating platforms of men, there must be a champion. But the craftiness of our hearts also tells us there must be a chump. If you have a champion, you have to have a chump. You have to have something to counterbalance the two. See, the reality of the gospel is that God doesn't side with would-be gospel superstars. That he's not rained down this special anointing on a few to leave out others. He's not put some up on a pedestal for the sake of saying, look at me. Now, we're all a little bit guilty of that because all it takes is for us to put on a new pair of shoes, a new outfit, get a new car. You know, we park it in the most, because normally when we get a new car, we get a new outfit because we want everything to be brand new that morning, and we park it in a special place so that everybody can see us when we walk in. And if you're like me and Patrick, you're going to blow the horn when you come in, make a little noise, and you might do a donut in the parking lot. No. See, nor does it hold on the side of the frickle and feckle fan base that chases after the pedestal of men to put one in high esteem while dogging the other. The gospel demands more of the church then and even more of us now. See, here's what's happening. You have to love the Church of Corinth if for no other reason it provides a textbook account of the how-tos and the how-not-tos of the church. Paul is banging their heads against the wall and they're not getting it. I remember when I was a boy, there was this young man, and he would bully me. And so my sisters all grew up fighting. They could fight. They were scrappers. And my sister says, he's not going to bully you anymore. And so one day, this is about fourth grade, we corner the boy, and my sister gets him on the ground, and she's banging his head on the ground, and he's smiling at her. And so I start tapping her on the shoulder and say, maybe we should run, because this is not bothering. In fact, he's enjoying this. That's almost what's happening with the Corinthian church theologically. Paul is banging their heads on the ground, and they're yet smiling at Paul, saying, it makes us no difference. We know what it is that we want. Young church, gifted church, powerful church, and they had already forgotten the founder and the track of the gospel he had laid down and started going after other things, more particularly other men. You've got to understand that the Corinthian church is like our church of today. It is set in a metroplex of cosmopolitan heresy like never before. There are temples and false gods and idols everywhere, and the Corinthian church is battling to come out of that. They're battling the demons in their own hearts, and what they're doing is what many of us do. They're vacillating between the two of whether or not I should chase after the gospel or whether or not I should flow with the culture. And so, since the Apostle Paul is the founder of the church, when it goes off the rail, it is the founder that they call to help them get out of what is called a cultural cul-de-sac. A cultural cul-de-sac for me is this. It is when you drive down, like my street, there's a cul-de-sac. You drive down it and there's no way out. It is people who've gotten themselves into a jam and they can't find their way out. And this is what is happening in the first four or five chapters of the book of Corinthians. There's all this disunity happening. And so they call on the great apostle who's now about to face his Roman judges. But they call on him and he writes back to them to tell them, listen, I need for you all to get yourselves together. Those in the church who love the church and who reached out to Paul for his advice and guidance. See, the Corinthian church is what I call American Idol on steroids. How many of you are American Idol fans? How many of you have made the mistake of voting for your favorite person each week? And to make sure you get your favorite person in, you might call 10 times. Then the wife gets the phone bill and is like, what is this? You know, and so it's American Idol on steroids. They have chosen for themselves four contestants to celebrate. You have Paul, you have Apollos, you have Cephas. And then there in the corner, there's this one guy he's almost forgotten about. There's the guy who set up the whole church, the one that we all tend to forget from time to time. There's that guy, Jesus Christ. We don't want to make mention of him. We just want to talk about those guys that we can see in the here and the now in our flesh. Think about it. When we think about conferences we want to go to, we don't really look at the content. We look at the personalities. We determine not on the content of the conference. We determine on the personality of the conference. We want to know who's going to be there. I know I sit in rooms all the time where we plan our conferences. And what we always say is we got to get us a big name speaker. We've even taken it to this degree. We are now even filling conferences with people who blog, who we've never heard even preach one inkling of the gospel, but they have a blog following of 500,000 people, and so we'll put them on the stage. What a disaster in the church of Jesus Christ. And so when we jump in here in verse 6, and forgive me if I just remind you of some things that Jeremy reminded you of last week, but when we jump in here in verse 6, he says, I've applied these things to myself and to Apollos, and it's inferred in the verse to Cephas for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against the other. I love that text. Here's what Paul says. Paul says, I reminded you of these things. What is he talking about? He says, since chapter 1, verse 10, I've been reminding you about the unity in the church, that there be no division among you, that you be of the same earnest care, the same mindset, the same judgment. He says, I've reminded you over and over again that that is neither Paul or Apollos, but it is Christ who brings the increase. He says, I want to remind you of these things, but more specifically, I want to remind you that we are only stewards, servants, and slaves. Stewards. That we've been entrusted with the gospel, that we don't own it, that it is not ours, That it's not a business to be passed down from one family member to the next. That it is a sacred trust, a fiduciary responsibility that we've been given as stewards. And so he reminds them that we're only stewards, but more than stewards, we're servants. We've been called to come and serve. So when you look at Paul in the gospel, when he says, I want to remind you of these things, he's speaking back to 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 5. He wants to remind you that we have done nothing. I know your favorite speaker, like my favorite speaker, soandso.org, where you can get all their tapes, CDs, and books, wear their shirts, you know. And when you're a preacher, sometimes you even pick up their illustrations and you mimic them. Yes, because we think sometimes that if I do what they do, say what they say, that I get to have what they have. No, Paul says stewards and servants. Then, you know, in his writing, Paul always talks about being a bond slave or a bond servant, which is this idea of being a slave, which means that I'm under the charge of a master, that I am controlled by somebody on the outside, that I am not, watch this here, I am not drawn in by the cries of the fan base. I have a couple of celebrity rappers in my church, and the struggle that they often tell me is that the loneliness that they face when they come off the stage. That on the stage, people are calling your name and they're moving to your music and they're shouting your name. And when you come off, after you've wrote all of the autograph, that then you're just back to a normal person. And Paul is saying, this is the life I live all the time as a steward, as a servant, and as a slave to the gospel of Jesus Christ. He says, this is the life that God has not only called me to, but this is the life that God calls every child of God to, who's been bought with the blood of God and sanctified with the Holy Spirit, that we're all called to be stewards, servants, and slaves of the gospel. That's what Jesus meant when he says, be willing to lay your life down for another. That's what he meant when he says that you're willing to give of yourself, out of yourself, to the place that you're dying. That's what Jesus meant when he says that we must die to ourselves, our own ambitions, our own goals, our own wants, our own desires. Until we've gotten there, we're not servants, we're not stewards, we're not slaves, we're just selfish. And here's the beautiful thing about it. We can be selfish while promoting somebody else. Because the idea that Paul lends to us is that while they were promoting their favorite speaker, they were really putting themselves on a pedestal. They were really setting themselves up. They were really laying themselves out, right? Paul is promoting a gift that the Corinthians are not accustomed to. He's talking about this gift of humility. They're not accustomed to that. Our church is not accustomed to that. Especially the culture I come out of. You know, the culture I come out of, when you reach a certain level of notoriety, people carry your Bible to the pulpit for you. People open doors for you. Huh? You become the holy man of God. Yes, you become special. You become different than everybody else. See, in the church, we do that. We set up a caste system in the church where we say the elders and the deacons and the ministers and the servants of here and the rest of us, we're just the peasants in the community of faith. And Paul is warning against that kind of mentality. He's warning against cliques in the church. He's warning against special clubs that set up. He's warning against, watch this here, the big I's and the small U's. He's warning against the us and the them in the church. He says these are the things that divide and kill us and eventually will conquer us if we're not careful. They will conquer us if not careful. One of the smartest things that you can do in warfare, watch this, is not to drop bombs on the enemy. It is to get the enemy to fight internally against the enemy. It is to drop leaflets to put doubt in the minds of the people, and it is to pick another leader on the inside and put them up against the dictator so that you can start an internal fashion. And Paul says in the church of God, there should be no internal fashions, that there's already one leader that we all run to, and that is the person of Jesus Christ. So Paul is saying this here. Paul is saying, look past the stage. Look past the pulpit. Look past the podium. Look past the .com. Look past the books. Look past the man and see Jesus standing there behind him. He says, let's get to that point. And so he runs the gamut on them. He says the gift of humility and submission is what's missing in the church of Corinth. And in many of our churches, even in our pews, we are missing that gift. Now, he says that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up. See, keep in mind that Paul has spent a year and a half with the church teaching and training them, and yet they have not embraced the fundamentals of Christianity and community. They've not gotten past their divisions and their fashions and all of their foolishness. He tells them, don't be puffed up. In other words, don't think more highly of people and of yourself than you are to. In other words, Paul says, I'm coming to bust your bubble. I was a kid, and we would have birthday parties, and I was the bad kid. And I would love it when one of my siblings would have a balloon, and they would be bringing that balloon home, right? And they'd be all excited about that balloon. And since I didn't have a balloon, the first chance I got, pop, bust their bubble. Here's what Paul is saying. Paul is saying, I need to bust your bubble because the balloon that you're holding onto is keeping you from seeing Christ. It's keeping you from seeing the glory and beauty that can only be found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. What's your balloon this morning? What keeps you puffed up? Is it your intellect? Is it your speaking gift, your singing gift? Is it how much money you make? Is it how much you give? Is it how much you serve? See, an idol could be a good thing to an extreme. What's your bubble? What is it that has you puffed up this morning? What puffs you up? What makes you believe that you are here and others are there? What makes you believe you deserve the seat at the head of the table? What makes you believe that you're the insider? And that because you've been chosen for something, that puts you on a whole nother pedestal. Paul says the danger of high-mindedness concerning others and ourselves, like the Corinthians, we have a tendency in us to measure ourselves by our heroes and our own giftedness. We have a tendency to measure ourselves, watch this here, by our heroes, and then we measure ourselves by people who we don't believe are on the same level we are. They don't know what I know. They don't study like I study. I had some guys at the house, some of the young guys, and one of the young guys, we got on this whole debate about speaking in tongues and when it's inappropriate and all that good stuff, and one of the young guys says, well, I've been trained to speak in tongues. Right, I can't look at my wife because I won't stop laughing. And right there, man, he began in the most eloquent fashion, began to speak in tongues for us, right? He says, I was trained to do it, right? He says, in fact, then another guy said, well, check out mine, right? And then somebody brought up the famous tongue word, shama, because whenever you hear in the black culture somebody speaking in tongues, it always ends with shama, right? And so they were going back and forth to say, man, listen, I learned better than you learned. And we were joking. But even in our culture, there is a vein in our Christian culture that says our gifts, we operate and flow in the greater gifts, the better gifts, healing, deliverance, tongues, giving. He says, there's the danger that you see in all of us, is that we all have a proclivity to exhort something in our own selves that makes us look bigger and better than the next person. We do. And we know that's true of us because, watch this here, lose 2 pounds and what do? All day? Huh? You in that mirror? Huh? Walk past your husband a few times? You might even change outfits, walk past him? Huh? How does this look, honey? Huh? We guys, we change shirts. You know, when we got that gut, we wear that big shirt. But then when we lose our stomach, we start putting on those tight shirts, right? We put on the Eddie V shirt, break out our little arms, our little muscles, right? We all have that in us, right? And Paul says, listen. He says, be careful. He says, and we all want to talk about who our heroes are and why they're our heroes. I was hanging out the other day with a young preacher, and he wanted to impress me. And so he began to talk to me about all of the famous, well-known preachers that he had been listening to for the past several months. And he began to name drop on me. Y'all know what name dropping is, right? He began to name drop about people who he had spent time with and hung out with. You know, maybe he went to a conference and he got like 2 minutes with them, you know, and he began to drop names, famous guys and well-known preachers. And he went on and on and on and on. And we're driving down the highway. We've driven about 20 minutes and he can't stop. And here's what he was trying to say. Look who I rock with. Look at the repertoire of knowledge that I've gained. That's the Corinthian church. And listen, in a Reformed faith, we're guilty of that all the time. We got our stack of books. We're book junkies, both men and women, our books and our DVD series. And we can't wait for somebody to say something we don't agree with so we can theologically bash them into the ground. We can't wait. No, no. And that's how this young man was. But verse 7 helps us because someone might be thinking, what's the danger in that? Verse 7 helps us because it says, for who sees anything different in you? Then watch this. What do you have that you did not receive? If then you received it, why do you boast if you did not receive it? So look what he says. Verse 7 says, you didn't earn it. You didn't, he says, it was given. It's a gift. Why do you boast in something that was already predetermined before the foundation of time to be yours? He says, why are you boasting? He says, it devalues the presence of God in the lives and it elevates the gift above the giver of the gift. He says, so that's the danger of being puffed up. When we're puffed up, guess what we're saying? We make God small and people big. And we're all guilty of that. We're guilty of that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we should not celebrate what God has done in the lives of others. But at the point that we put people as competing factions, we turn it into a theological boxing match. Theological MMA. It's dangerous. Right? Why do we do that? Because we are under the misguided belief that God only works through a few. That was the misguided belief that the Corinthian church had. That when you pastor an average church, and by average I mean average size church, a couple of hundred people, 150, 200 people, people say, well, you're not a mega church, and so obviously y'all not doing it big. And so they make the ill-gotten mistake that wherever a crowd is, it must be going down. Some of the best concerts I've been to where the band just loved what they were doing were not crowded. And the worst thing you can do is go to a concert and realize that they're lip-singing to you the whole time. But we do the same deal with church. We say, well, there's no crowd there. So simply, if there's no crowd, it can't be God. Paul says no. Paul says, look at the lives of those who are leading and see whether or not you see the servant, the steward, the slave. See how their lives are exhibiting and living out the gospel. Paul is saying, keep your heroes, but don't be held hostage by your heroes. See, because here's the deal. Without God, we're all spiritually bankrupt. Without God, we're all spiritually bankrupt. I don't care what your gifting is, how good the cookies are. Without God, it's all stale. And so Paul is saying, without God, none of this counts. None of this matters. He is the one that gives the gifts. He says, he is the one that raises up one and puts down another. He is the one that we should be looking to. Without him, none of this makes sense. And so Paul, he continues to go in on me. Here's what I love. God's spiritual banking system does not require deposits by us. In other words, God's spiritual banking system does not require deposits by us. It's not like Bank of America. In other words, in God's system, you put nothing in, but you get to draw everything out. Study, yes. Pray, yes. But no, it's going to be God working in and through you, and normally not because of what you've done, but because of what he's doing, so that the gospel can be magnified, so that disciples can be made through the face of the earth. But it's never dependent on what you do. And see, that was the mistake of the Corinthians. The Corinthians had decided that God works through a few, and the rest of us were just underservings. And that in order to get to that level, there was all these extra things that we needed to do. And so Paul, for the next several verses, Paul does what I call sanctified sarcasm. Have you ever met somebody like that? They have sanctified sarcasm, Patrick? Yes? Have you ever? And I love it, though. I do. I love it. I love it. I love watching him work with people and play the cat and mouse game. I just love it, because it and then sometimes I feel bad for the other person, right? But most of the time I get a big kick out of it. And so sanctified sarcasm. Here's what Paul says. Paul begins to work with them through this system of sanctified sarcasm. And so Paul points out to them. He says to them, already you have all you want. In other words, Paul says, you've already obtained. You've already become gods in your own eyes. You've already become special. You've already went to the third heaven, as Paul would say. Already you have what you want. Paul says, you've already become rich. You've already kings. You've already done all this stuff without us. You've already made it happen. Since you already have ascended to the high and lofty places, Paul says, let us rock with you. Paul says, since you're already where you're supposed to be, Paul says, can you just let me join the team? Can you just let me in? And really, here's what I love about Paul is when he calls them chief apostles, he's really insulting them. Have you ever met somebody like that? They can insult you without you knowing they're insulting you, and it takes you a couple of days to figure out that they just insulted you. Yeah. And so Paul is doing that with spiritual sarcasm. Paul is saying, since you've already arrived, since you're already there, Paul says, why don't you just let me in on it anyway? This is the guy who founded the church. He is the first pastor. He is the guy who set up the 501c3, so to speak. He is the guy who determined what the value statements were going to be, the mission statement was going to be, the core values of the church. Paul says, but I see y'all already got the mission down. Y'all already have attained. Y'all already made it happen. Paul says, since you're already kings, can you just let me in? Can you just let me be a part of what it is that God is doing in and through your life? Paul then says, I think not. Paul says, I think not. I think not. Paul understood that Jesus came and he didn't make a reputation for himself. That if Jesus is our motto, it can never be about us. It has to always be about him. I love it, man, when we figure out that it's not about how big we grow our church or how many disciples we make, that our names may never be in lights, but if he is being glorified, then we all win. And Paul says, I think not. And he begins to make these transitions and these sarcastic statements to them that I love, that as you read them, that they should make you laugh and bring you joy at the same time. Paul says, for I think that God had exhibited us apostles as last of all, like men sentenced to death, because we have become spectacles to the world, to angels and to men. Paul says, listen, in verse 9, Paul says, listen, he transitions here to what true calling looks like. He calls it a death sentence. It's a death sentence to follow Jesus. In other words, Paul paints this picture when he uses the word spectacle. It's where we get our word theater from. And what he's really talking about is during our day, they would bring prisoners into a Roman Colosseum to fight a wild beast. Here's the problem with that. These were prisoners who, unlike the prisoners we got where they get 3 hot meals and a cot. No, it wasn't that day. If you were a prisoner then, if there was nobody bringing you food, there was nobody bringing you clothing, you just died naked and malnourished. That's how it was in the Roman day. But they would bring these prisoners into the Colosseum, 50, 60,000 people cheering, knowing that they were being brought into the Colosseum to fight a wild animal, a wild beast whom they had not fed. And that, so when Paul uses the term spectacle, here's what it is. Here's the picture he's painting, that we're being led into the Colosseum to face the wild beast, to be torn apart. Paul says, that's the gospel that I see. That's what servanthood looks like. That's what it looks like to be a steward and a slave. And so Paul paints this picture for them of them going in as condemned prisoners for a sports fight with a wild beast. These prisoners, Paul makes it clear. Paul says, here we are on full display, normally naked. See, that's what was happening in Paul's day. And Paul says they've made us a spectacle. The gospel calls us to be on full display, that God himself has not made us famous or given us fame or made us powerful and elite, but he's made us prisoners. In fact, that on our back, he's put us in the white stripy jumpsuit and we're headed for the guillotine. We're headed to be killed. He says, this is what leadership looks like in the church. Not, I know we love David and Goliath. We want the guy with the rock to take out the giant. Paul says, no. Paul says, we willingly walk into the Colosseum knowing that death is imminent, that it's before us. He uses this huge visual illustration to make a spiritual point, that are you willing to die to your own wants, dreams, and desires? Or have you become so comfortable with rubs on the back and people calling your name and people chanting your favor? Had a member die this week. She was ushering. Actually, a month ago this Sunday, she was on the door ushering. She went to the doctor, had a gallbladder surgery, found out she had cancer. Inoperable, untreatable. And last week, when my wife and I, we went to go visit this dear, precious saint of God. First deal she says is, Pastor, I need to pay my tithes. I'm sitting, Lord, why her? But then she says to me from her deathbed, knowing that death is imminent, she says, I'm at peace with God. She says, I love my church. I love the people. But not one time did she complain about being in that bed and cancer ravishing her body. She's in pain. Yes. Maybe some disappointments? Yes. But for the joy that was placed before her, there she said her life spoke. For the few days prior that she could talk, prior to getting to the place where she could no longer speak, as I went back to the hospital and talked with the chaplain, and he began to share stories with me of him and her conversations, it was all about God. See, in the end, does not matter where you live, what you drive, how many people call your name, how much money that's in the bank. The question at hand, was it about God? See, that's what Paul is trying to get the Corinthian church to understand through these first four chapters. Can you make it about God? Can you make it about him? Don't get your focus off. Make it about him. Don't get sidetracked by putting people on pedestals. You yourselves don't become puffed up. And if I exalt you, know that it's me working through you and it's not you, because if you remember, you are the scum of the earth. You are snails. You are useless without me. You say, Pastor, where's the good news? The good news is that Christ is beckoning us back to himself and asking us to make a mid-course direction, that he is saying, make it all about me. That's what Paul is getting across. All through his sarcasm, he's constantly coming back to God that's working in them and through them. Every message of Paul is about the gospel, and he's saying to them, this is how God gets glory. Not when we are, watch this here, not when we are put on a pedestal, but when we're brought low, that people might see the glory of God work through us. Very few people pray for suffering. No, we pray for blessings. But very few of us say, we like to quote Job, though you slay me, yet will I trust you. But none of us want the slain. To the boys in my church, Dad was about to whoop them one Sunday, one evening. And he asked them, do you want a whooping? And the oldest little boy said, no, Daddy, we want grace. Right? Because what we ultimately want is we want all of the benefits of the blessing without any of the struggle and the pain and the sorrow and the suffering. The Bible often talks more about suffering than it does talk about benefit. The early church understood that the moment that you came to Christ, you now had a contract on your life. And I could over-spiritualize this here, and I could go all the way to my charismatic Pentecostal side and tell you that the devil now is chasing you down. No, they understood that in a real sense, that the moment that they came to know Christ, that immediately their lives were on the line, that there was a culture around them that wanted to chop their heads off, that there was a culture around them that says that if you're not lifting up Rome, you're in direct opposition, that if you identify with Jesus, that your life now is on the line. They understood that very distinctly. See, for us, we lose it because we live in a culture that feeds our egos and our Christendom. It feeds it. We've created a whole counterculture among the culture. We have. 20 years ago, there were no major Christian book distributors or stores. Now you can go in a Christian bookstore. There's a book and a DVD series about everything. And it's normally, now you have some people, and I'm not knocking anybody. God bless them. I know God is working through all that. Let me be clear. But some people have not only roles, some people have whole sections. And they got a whole fan base that wear the shirts. You know? They had a whole fan base that wear the shirts. Some of us, we're like that, you know. We still wearing the Bob Marley shirt long after Bob is dead. Want you to know who our favorite singers are. We do the same deal in the gospel, and Paul warns us about that. And he continues this contrast to let them know. He continues to beat home this here. And the crazy thing about Paul beating this home, nobody says, wait a minute. Nope. Paul just has to keep banging it in to them. He says, we are fools for Christ's sake. Raka. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are held in honor, and we are in disrepute. He says, Paul is saying, look at us. And the whole time, Paul is saying, look at us. Look how we live our lives in comparison to those that you hold on a pedestal. Look how humble we have become. But you say, this is the way. He says, to this present hour, we are hungry and thirst. We are poorly dressed and buffeted and homeless. And we labor working with our hands. Because in that day, to work with your hands, in a Roman economy caste system, meaning that you were of the lowest of the low. Not only were the Corinthians arrogant, right? They had the Kardashian disease, that they had to have somebody for everything in their lives. I need somebody to carry my purse, carry my water. Even the babies need assistance. So if you work with your hands, you were really considered the least of these. Paul says, this is who we are, those of us who have labored and started the church, that we are not famous, that is for his fame and not ours. When the church of Jesus Christ understands we have not been called to compete with the world, that we are called to be countercultural to the world, when we get it through our heads that God has set us apart and sanctified us to make a difference in the world and not to infiltrate it and become part of it, but we are called to stand out like a sore thumb, bang with the hammer. But we keep working just like the Corinthians, to sound like them, look like them, talk like them, act like them, love like them, recruit and apprise like them. We want so much to be like the world that it is said now that you can go to church and see absolutely no difference. And here's what Paul is warning us against through sarcasm. He is saying, I see you, you're looking good, girl. I see you with your latest Beth Moore, Joel Osteen series under your arm. I see you. I see you with your t-shirt, with your favorite scripture on the back of it. I see you. He says, but what I don't see you humbled, serving, sacrificing, dying. I got the privilege of preaching in Angola State Prison in Louisiana for 3 years, and I preached to many men on death row. And the guards, to intimidate you when you are a new preacher, you would preach in a particular camp, and it was the camp where the gurney was. And this one particular guard, when I would preach to the men, he would open the curtains to the gurney because he wanted them to see this is your end result. And I'll never forget a brother, Larry Manuel. Brother Larry Manuel would always say, they can take this life, but I'm already been made free. He had already realized, I have a natural death sentence, but I've already died to Christ. So once you die to Christ, there's nothing else to lose. Everything is gained from there on. And the reason we're still fighting this life and we're scratching and holding on and beating each other up and dogging each other, because we have not yet died. Here's what Paul is saying to the Corinthians. He is saying, you need to become a bug and you need to be stepped on to really understand. That's why he says we are the scum of the earth. None of us are running around collecting those flying water bugs in our house, holding them in jaws, putting them on pedestals. No, we step on them. Paul says, consider us like them for the sake of Christ. He says, this is what the gospel is about. And he reminds them over and over and over again, we've been persecuted and yet we have endured. We've been slandered and we entreat. And we have become and still are like the scum of the world, the refuse of all things. He says, we do all of this because of what he talked about in the earlier verses, that Christ might be glorified in us. So when we have the problem with putting people on pedestals and making people more famous than God in platforms and puffiness, is that it makes God small. It is said that when an idol is killed, a false god is killed. And you saw this here even in modern time, when a dictator is killed, the first thing you must do is push over the statue of the dictator. It must be torn down. We have to ask ourselves this morning, what are my idols? What is it that God is trying to tear down in my life? Telling a young man, he's bragging about him and his wife date nights and how much he loved his wife and all this. And it got to the point where I realized he had placed her on this pedestal. She was the best wife, the best mom, the best cook, the best housekeeper, the best working woman. She was the best of everything. And I looked at him, I said, God is a jealous God and he kills idols. You may be a hitman unknowingly. What are the idols of your heart that God has to kill, that he has to trample over? Are you willing? Because this is what we do. We protect them. Are you willing to step aside so that God can bulldoze the idols of your heart, that he might be glorified? Are you willing to be clothed in stewardship, slaveship, and servanthood, that God might get glory out of your life? That's what he's after. May God bless you and keep you. In Jesus' precious and most holy name, let us pray.